we went to Nashville because Keith Urban was the big country star at the time for EMI, and we met with him, and it was a very intimate dinner, and I was sitting next to Nicole Kidman. So I had, you know, dinner with Keith and Nicole Kidman, and I thought, oh my goodness, where have I landed? This is fantastic.
Hello and welcome to the Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest today is Isabel Garvey, who's just left her role as Chief Operating Officer at Warner Music UK. Having left Ireland for London and a career in investment banking, her world suddenly changed when she was offered a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to join the glitz and glam of the music industry, and she spent 20 years working in it in the UK. From EMI to Warner Music and Universal's Abbey Road Studios, she has seen dramatic changes in that period. Isabel, you're very welcome to the Insights podcast. And indeed, we'll start by saying congratulations on winning the Outstanding Contribution Honour at the 2025 Women in Music Awards. Quite the achievement. But look, let's go right back. It all started, you grew up initially in County Wicklow, was it?
I was born, yeah, in County Wicklow, then moved to just down the road here to Ranelagh when I was about seven. So I consider myself a Dubliner, really.
Well, that's fair enough. You were the eldest, I gather, or you are the eldest of four girls. Now, how did that work out?
Well, they will tell you. I'm just the bossy older sister. And I think we, you know, we'll get into it later. But my poor father of four daughters, we drove him demented with all of the Annie tapes and the bad pop we listened to in the car. But yeah.
And at some stage, even though you were set fair for, I think, a pretty good and rewarding career in finance, music came a calling.
It did. So I left Morgan Stanley and I moved to private equity, actually, which was just, you know, more deal making, but at a slightly different pace. And it was quite fun. And I was looking to change funds that I was working for. I wanted to get to a fund where I was closer to the businesses we were acquiring. And one of the headhunters that was working with me said, can I throw you in as a total wild card for a job at EMI Music? And I thought, well, people do MBAs for this, you know, kind of change. So I'll go for the interview. And Sean, I did one of the weirdest interviews in my life. I thought there were cameras in the room. I didn't know what was going on. One guy was asking me a question and then he'd leave the room and the other guy was reading the newspaper and I just kept going. And I think I was probably the only candidate that just kept going. But they offered me the role and I just thought, well, you know, this is a real once in a lifetime opportunity to see a very different industry. And it was an industry as well that was on the crux of massive change. You know, Napster was at its height. So there was a lot of illegal downloading. CD sales were starting to drop. Apple iTunes had just launched. It was about 1 or 2% of revenue when I joined.
But stay with the interview process for a minute. I mean, was that a kind of a tactical approach they took to just try to keep you or throw the potential hire or executive off balance? I mean, did you figure out what exactly they were at?
I mean, I assumed they were doing really clever psychological analysis on me, but actually it transpires I worked for the then chairman and vice chairman of the recorded music side. They both just had ADD, I think. They were both really different brains. David Munns was a hugely creative character. Alan Levy was the numbers guy, but they were just busy getting on to the next thing. And that's what it was like working with them. You know, you just had to be really nimble and kind of garner what you could as quick as you could.
How long then did it take you to find your feet in the music industry, initially, as we say, with EMI?
I mean, I had, that role was the most excellent grounding you could ever have in an industry, because I obviously went in working for the guys who ran the whole global business. It was headquartered out of London at the time. And I travelled the world with them and literally learnt the whole industry, every territory, top to bottom, what genres worked in what territory, how the finances were different in different markets. So I really got to grips with the business of music very quickly. And then, you know, you start to appreciate that constant clash. And it's kind of a theme throughout my career of creativity and commerce and how they work together, because you have to, you know, at the end of the day, it's a joyous business to be in, where you're, you know, developing the talent of the future and, you know, creating music that brings joy to a big global audience.
Yeah, as you say, the intersection of creativity and commerce. But you've been careful to point out, I've seen in a few interviews you've given, that you're not an A&R person. In other words, the artist and repertoire side of it. And they're the people who find and develop the talent.
That's right.
But you say that's not you.
That is absolutely not me. And the world is a better place for it, Sean, I think. No, I am definitely on the business side of music and always have been. But it's like I say, it's a delicate balance because, you know, at the end of the day, you have an artist who wants to, you know, create beautiful music and project their image and their values through what they're writing. And it's our job to try and help them make money, but not over commercialize things because that, you know, they have to be authentic to themselves.
I should have asked you this earlier, maybe at the very start. I mean, what about your own personal tastes and interests musically?
I am a pop music sheep. So it's quite funny. You know, my colleagues quite find it quite funny. You know, I work with people who have encyclopedic knowledge of music. You know, they can name the band and the previous 10 bands the lead singer was in. And, you know, it's incredible. But I just love the kind of the top 40. And I have, you know, I did an interview relatively recently where I was asked about the songs of my life and, you know, how it kind of defines, I guess, my taste in music. And you can kind of get into your own head about it thinking, oh, God, I better pick something really cool that people aren't, you know, that they won't have thought of. But actually, when I look back on it, it is kind of the chart toppers through the decades that are the things that have really struck a chord with me or a meaningful, you know, to a memory.
Was there a bit of, despite what you said earlier about driving your dad around the bend, was there a little bit of parental influence though in your taste in music?
I think early days, my dad, I think because he had four daughters, used to lock himself away in our front room listening to jazz on a Sunday morning. So his favourite tune was Take Five. So that's in my head when I think of him on a Sunday morning. So that, you know, and my mum is very into classical music. So music was always in our house. But, you know, I wasn't one of those people who, you know, said by hook or by crook, I will go and work in the music business. I just had this, you know, beautifully serendipitous kind of leap into it. And
so when you were travelling the world, as you say, Isabella, with those two gentlemen, what kind of people did you meet? I mean, you must have met some big names in your time.
I've met some very big names. Yeah. I think I have so many stories of people that I've met, and everyone has been delightful. You know, I haven't had many kind of diva encounters. I think one that sticks out, particularly in those early years, I mean, this was the noughties where I was jumping on private jets to do all of these business meetings. I mean, it was the music industry, as you see in the movies a little bit. But we went to Nashville because Keith Urban was the big country star at the time for EMI. And we met with him and it was a very intimate dinner. And I was sitting next to Nicole Kidman. So I had, you know, dinner with Keith and Nicole Kidman. And I thought, oh, my goodness, where have I landed? This is fantastic. And she was absolutely amazing. She is so clever. And they had great wit between them. It was good fun.
That's that's high altitude stuff.
Yes.
in any industry to meet people like that. And was there a lot of that?
Yeah, there's a fair bit. You know, I was on the coattails of the chairman and vice chairman, you know, so I kind of went wherever they went. But even as I've gone through my career, you know, particularly at Abbey Road Studios, you know, you see everyone that comes through the doors there. And actually what's interesting about the studios, and you probably see this here in RTE as well, is artists are going in to do their work at that point. You know, they're not in promo mode or, you know, show mode. And you meet a very different artist in that environment. And you really kind of, I guess you have the privilege of seeing them deep in their own craft and what they're trying to do. So, yeah, I guess I've met in the very showy guises and then in a very relaxed environment where you're having a toasted cheese sandwich with Noel Gallagher. You know, it's...
Which of you was having the toasted cheese sandwich?
Both of us. We both have a love for toasted cheese sandwiches.
I see. And did you ever see himself and the brother in the same room?
No, never in the same room. And we actually had to make concerted efforts to make sure they were not in the same room.
That sounds like organising people who come into debate in studio, making sure that they don't meet beforehand.
Exactly.
Otherwise, they might actually start agreeing with one another.
Which would make for terrible radio.
Absolutely. You got it in one. Look, we've started that down the Abbey Road, as it were, so you might as well stay on that one. I mean, you would have come across people like Paul McCartney, I'm sure.
I did. I mean, I think I was probably in month two at Abbey Road and Paul McCartney wandered down the corridor towards me and I just thought, oh my goodness, where am I? So again, that was another dreamy job, right? You know, to be trusted with such a British cultural icon and such an important kind of music mecca was just phenomenal. And I got a brilliant remit, which was, you know, here's a studio that has, you know, got brand recognition of Coke practically around the world. But we hadn't really ever done anything outside of Northwest London. And so what can we do with that? And so we built several kind of adjacent businesses, but also always with the kind of perspective of it must be authentic to what Abbey Road really stands for. So we did some of the obvious stuff, like built a retail business because there, you know, we reckon about 400,000 to 500,000 people hit that crossing every year. So we built a retail store so they could buy their souvenir t-shirt while they were there, which is a bit of a no-brainer. And then two things that we did that were kind of, I think, had a really pivotal role in kind of changing the perception of Abbey Road as a brand and how it sits with modern music makers was we built an education business. So there's this lovely history of kind of mentorship of how you become a senior engineer at Abbey Road. And the joke was it takes longer to become a doctor than an engineer rather than a doctor, because it's an 8-year path to kind of the senior engineer. Anyway, we took all of those learnings and put it into a diploma course for production and engineering. And we started with the flagship school in London and then franchised. I think it's franchised in about 8 territories now. And it's just, you know, it's small, it's niche, but 90% of students are getting jobs straight into the music industry straight away. So it's something I'm very proud of. It's done really well.
Is it a course that's hard to get into?
Yeah, you have to be able to play an instrument. You have to show your previous work in production, and you have to kind of convey your passion. But it's got applicants in multiples of the available seats all of the time.
Is it a very expensive course to take?
It's expensive enough. I haven't looked at the latest price tag, but I think when I left, it was about £15,000. But if you're going straight into work, that's pretty good value given you pay £9,000 for a university per year and you've got 3 years.
And how long is the course there?
A year. So it's really condensed. There's like only about 4 weeks holiday. So it's all very, it's crash course.
Did you have much conversation with Paul McCartney? Would he say anything beyond hello?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He grew up in Abbey Road, didn't he? So it's very much his home. He knows all of the characters. You know, Abbey Road's a funny place. Like, we had a microphone engineer there in his late 70s who had, you know, tuned the microphones for the Beatles first time round. You know, so there's all of these characters that he still knows incredibly well. And he's just a really charming, lovely gentleman who's, you know, and of course he can roam the corridors. He's Paul McCartney, right?
Who else would you have come across there, or did you?
I mean, I think it's probably a case of who didn't I, but, you know, there's a few. I mean, I met Sir Elton John. I had a lovely moment actually with U2. So being an Irish woman, it's always good to have U2 in studio. They did a Christmas special 1 year, and we Studio One is the big orchestral studio in Abbey Road. And they dressed it up to look, you know, very showy for TV. But they did, you know, a whole gig there with about 20 of us standing in front of it. So, I mean, that is a privilege.
And you had quite an interesting conversation, maybe slightly awkward at the beginning. Was it with The Edge?
Oh, yeah. That was after that. They came in to listen back to an Atmos mix that had been done of one of their albums. And he's such a lovely man. I had a great chat with him. And I realised afterwards when I went to the bathroom that I'd had a poppy seed bagel for my lunch. So I had black teeth while I was chatting to The Edge. Poor man. But he was very nice. They were delighted there was an Irish woman running Abbey Road. But yeah, I have plenty of those awkward stories.
It wasn't just the individual artists or bands like U2, but you would have seen full orchestras there as well, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. And that, to be honest, was the most, you know, hair-raising, goosebump-inducing experience I had there. I had one beautiful moment where I think it was the London Symphony Orchestra were playing the Grateful Dead soundtrack that Ennio Morricone had had written, and both Tarantino and Ennio Morricone were in the studio while it was being played back. Just the sound of an orchestra doing a big, you know, orchestral piece like that is incredible.
Who else stands out in your memory?
Ed Sheeran was in a few times as well. He is an incredible artist, but also just an absolute gentleman. I've never heard a bad word said about him.
I think you might have been in the room when he came in to actually, was it sing a cappella,
yes,
one of his songs?
So that was when I was at Warner Music. So this is kind of back to your point about A&R executives and people who can pick the next star. I mean, it is kind of black box magic stuff as far as I'm concerned. So, yeah, I was in a marketing meeting and Ed Sheeran had just been signed and they brought him into the boardroom to play A-Team on his ukulele. And it was you know, brilliant, really good. But I thought, how are they going to make this work? Like one guy and a ukulele. He's clearly incredibly talented, but how are they going to make this work? A year later, and you think, oh my goodness, it's like that vision and ability to connect artistry with audience is just, you know, it's a different way to the way my brain works.
But he's got a lot to answer for popularizing the ukulele.
He does.
There's no doubt about it. There are people who take it up. you really wish they hadn't.
I've been to many a school concert where the ukulele has been murdered.
Yeah. So I know we've been chopping a little bit back and forth, but that, I suppose, is part of what happens in that industry. You've had two periods with Warner. You went initially from EMI to Warner. How did that come about?
So that was interesting. That was in a period where the music industry was looking at something called 360 rights. So the industry kind of finally realized, well, we're investing all of this money in building artists and brands, but we're only taking part in one income stream, which then was the CD or the download. Actually, we should be looking at, you know, how can we help with live? How can we help with merchandise? You know, can we get some of that revenue? And Warner at the time wanted, and still to this day, wanted to do that in a very genuine way and say, well, let's build businesses that can deliver, you know, live capabilities and merchandise and branding. So they liked the fact that I had a mergers and acquisitions background or finance background and now understood the music industry. So I went across to them to essentially acquire as many of these extended rights businesses as we could. So we bought about 13 businesses in 12 months. So it was a very aggressive and quick acquisition spree. And then worked to kind of integrate those into the businesses. It really transformed some of the continental European businesses like France and Spain. And then I took on the European digital business as well, set up the first data science team, looked after, I became kind of the new business girl, let's put it that way. All of that was kind of under my remit at Warner.
And it seems to have worked out very well for you because I suppose, as you say, you went in there at the cusp of a lot of change in the early days, and there were, okay, tremendous challenges, but tremendous opportunities as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is the thing that has, you know, kept me in the industry for so long is it has been disrupted a number of times now, but also it's an industry that has kind of had to lean into it. So my roles have changed as, you know, each kind of new technical disruption has come. I've really enjoyed the kind of the mental gymnastics that has involved. But, you know, in my time in the industry, you know, we went from 2%, like I said, when I started, to then, you know, downloads really taking hold. Then I did the first Spotify deal in Europe, and the Americans couldn't quite believe that, you know, the next phase of growth was going to come from a European business. And then subscription really took hold. And now we're in an era of like, well, what's AI going to bring? So, you know, it just feels like every decade almost, you know, the next technical disruption has come. But we lean into it and it's scary and it's challenging, but it's really interesting.
Yeah, what do you think AI will bring?
I mean, it's the multi-million dollar question across multiple industries, isn't it? But I think for music, it feels, on the one hand, very exciting. On the other hand, you know, we need to be very, very thoughtful. So, you know, again, having sat at Abbey Road, I think AI, one of the things I didn't tell you was we set up a music tech incubator. So we were helping tech startups get into the music business. And we sponsored actually a lot of AI businesses through that tech incubator. And in those early stages of AI, you could see how it was going to enhance human creativity, right? Because suddenly, you know, you and I, who may not be Pro Tools professionals, could actually start to produce really music really, really well, or it would help you dig out the samples that you wanted for your various tracks. And it just made the kind of the mundane, repeatable tasks of production really quick. So therefore, you could become even more creative in the studio. And roll forward to today, and that's still obviously happening. It's just happening at a much faster pace. And you and I could, you know, still record a track together and, you know, do something that sounds incredible with, you know, a Suno or an Udio or any of these businesses that are really tapping into generative AI and generating music.
I suppose there always is that sense of apprehension when something new comes along. I mean, it's not today or yesterday when there was that song Video Killed the Radio Star.
Yes, exactly.
And that kind of idea and wariness,
yeah,
it's kind of gone down the generations, but somehow people manage to be still standing, you know, when something old gives way to something new.
Well, you're 100% right. I used to always say this when I was at Abbey Road, actually, when the synthesizer first came out, the musicians union tried to make it illegal to use the synthesizer because it was replacing musicians, you know, and AI is the next generation of that. I think that's taking the very positive lens on it. You also have to be, you know, quite cautious, because the reality is, you know, we've got big tech companies that are learning on all of the music that's out there without paying for it. So, you know, we have to be very thoughtful about what IP means in an AI world, how we protect human-led creativity, let AI augment it but not replace it. So there's a very fine balanced tread, which is kind of regulatory and just how the music industry strikes deals with these new tech providers.
But there must be a serious concern, though, that you know, people will have their work stolen. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's happening, for instance, in the literary field, mm-hmm. and in the journalistic field, where, you know, AI can just absorb huge quantities of exactly. people's work and then churn it out at no gain to the initiators.
100%, and that is the challenge. And I think it's the law, certainly in America and the UK, which is kind of my point of reference looking at this, is a little clearer if, you know, you're just trying to replicate an Ed Sheeran song, for an example, because, you know, you've typed in "make me a song like Ed Sheeran," it's very clear what you're doing. So you can't say that he shouldn't receive some kind of economic gain for that. It's more that the AI companies now can just learn from the plethora of music that's out there and create a job. You may not even have to prompt it with Ed Sheeran. You know, you can just be clever enough with your prompts to get something that sounds like it. But our feeling as an industry is that there should be a fee to learn, and then we work together to have kind of ethical models that make sure that everybody, whether you're a songwriter, a musician, a gigging musician, or the artist themselves, that there's some monetization in there.
But how important was the idea of ethics ever in the music industry?
That's a big question. I think, you know, if you look at media across the board, there was definitely shades of grey in certain decades. I think in my time in the music industry, I think it has evolved so much. And also what technology has brought for the artist and the audience is complete transparency and choice. So actually the industry has to be completely above board and, you know, as ethical as they can be.
Aside from the two gentlemen who interviewed you with their quirky approach to the business, you would have come across on the business side of things. There's a figure, a guy called Tony Harlow, who I gather is described as the label boss's label boss. So tell me about your dealings with him.
So Tony Harlow was my boss this time around at Warner. He was the CEO of Warner Music. And he is one of those music encyclopedias. You know, he has worked in the music industry all his life and is just a fantastic advocate for artists, but also an incredible brain and can work across, you know, all of the commercial and technical quandaries of the business. But he and I started talking about me taking the role at Warner on a park bench in Fulham, because it was in the midst of COVID and we figured out we both lived in Fulham and he had just taken up his role and knew that he needed a second in command. So we've built this great relationship between us and kind of divided up the various kind of tasks to try and bring, you know, Warner.
This was, I think, at a time when I think Abbey Road had to close for a while, something it didn't have to do during World Wars.
That's correct. So, yeah, I was still at Abbey Road at the time. And yeah, COVID hit and we closed the doors. And like you say, it hadn't closed ever since its opening. Even the Second World War didn't stop it in its tracks. So it was a horrible moment closing the doors behind me. But we actually got it up and running again quite quickly. 6 or 8 weeks later, we were back open for business. And Sean, we had some funny conversations. I had to speak to scientists from Imperial College about how far tuba spit goes when, you know, the musician is playing, to make sure that we had perspex in the right place, but not so close that we deafened the tuba player. So we had to go through all of that, you know, scientific analysis and figure out how we were going to set up the room to keep recording, but we managed it.
And you kept it going. But meanwhile, I suppose, you know, you did 7 years, long enough, despite the excitement and the glam and all the rest of it. Warner wanted you back.
They wanted me back, yeah. And I had a really lovely time at Abbey Road and, you know, done a lot of interesting things, but it was time to kind of pass it on to the next person. And yeah, Warner came calling, and hence the conversations on park benches with Tony. And yeah, I moved across about 3 years ago.
And in, I think, was that when you went in at the deep end facing these this inquiry about misogyny in the music industry?
Yes, there's nothing like starting a job and then going straight into a government inquiry. Yeah, I was the Warner representative on that panel.
Tell me a bit more about that inquiry. I mean, misogyny, is there much of it, or was there much of it? And, you know, did you have to fess up, as it were?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would start that by saying I think misogyny is alive and well in most industries. I think the reason government were mounting an inquiry into music, and actually the broader creative sphere, they also were looking at TV as well. I think there's a number of components. One is the music industry is actually really big. You know, I was in recorded music. There's also publishing. There's live. There's management. You know, there are a lot of people touching the music industry. And also, it's a gig economy, right? Most people are freelancers. And then layer in on top of that, you know, young talent that's trying to, you know, become the next thing. And you kind of, there's a bit of vulnerability there. So if you put all of that melee together, you know, I understand why they came inquiring. And, you know, there were some horrific tales of people who testified in front of that that committee. My role was to represent Warner Music, and, you know, it's big corporate American business. You know, we have HR systems, we look at our diversity quotas on everything. So from my perspective, you know, over the last kind of 10, 20 years, A, it's improved a lot, but there's no deeply ingrained bad behaviour, let's put it that way.
At the risk of sounding misogynistic in the way I ask this question, was it a bit cynical of them to send in a woman only 6 weeks in the job to represent them in that inquiry?
You know what, we did get a bit of flack for that, and it was, Tony and I had a conversation about it because we knew it was coming up, and he was very happy to testify. But his view was it would actually be better having someone who can talk about lived experience rather than a man mansplaining that misogyny didn't exist. And actually, when you looked at the panel, I was the most senior person. We were all women in front of that panel, but I was the most senior woman in the recorded music.
What about your own direct experience of it?
You know, I've definitely had bad behaviour, but I don't think I have stories that are any worse than anyone in any other industry. And, you know, I think, you know, it all depends on, you know, thankfully I never had anything that was, you know, really horrific sexual harassment or anything. But I have had, you know, people ask me to make cups of tea, and, you know, women can't do that job because they have families and they always prioritize their family. You know, I've had, you know, there's just always the little kind of chips away at the
armor. Bit of condescension?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And how would you have responded when somebody suggested, Isabel, I'd love a cup of tea?
I think when I was younger, I didn't really know what to do with that. But now when people say it, or it, not that it's happened particularly recently, but I do remember a phase where I quite enjoyed doing it, where someone would tell me they'd have a tea or a coffee, and then sitting down, they realise I was leading the meeting. That was quite fun.
That probably put them at a disadvantage and maybe worked in your favour,
exactly,
you know,
exactly.
Over time. Yeah. You talk about quotas and making sure that people are looked after in that respect. I mean, would it be the case, though, that maybe less talented people might get more support than they would deserve because of their gender or because of the colour of their skin or whatever?
No, I mean, again, I can only talk about the businesses I've worked in. But I'm, as a feminist, I hate, you know, the idea of quotas, quite frankly. And we aren't a business that works towards quotas, but we are very thoughtful about the, you know, the diversity of our talent base. And it's all about getting, you know, representation in early in the kind of the junior ranks, and then really sponsoring people through. So no, you know, people who didn't have the talent or the know-how to be in the roles were not in the roles. It was very much about bringing talent through. And I actually said it in my speech at the awards thing before Christmas. There's a generation in Warner Music in particular now of women coming through who are absolutely phenomenal. And so I'm very excited about
you,
what the
you're talking about
like.
People like Dua Lipa, Charlie XCX, Pink Panthers and others?
Yeah, so that's on the artist side. I mean, the female domination in the charts at the moment is absolutely a delight to see. You know, you've got plenty of US artists, but like you say, that there's a number of UK artists who are just, Olivia Dean's another one, who are just doing incredibly well. So there's real domination on the artist side, but I was actually talking about the management talent that's coming through. Because when you look at, and again, I had to look at this for the misogyny inquiry, but when you look at all of the statistics of male to female executives right the way through the tiers of the organisation, it's really, really equal until you get to the top tier. And that's because, you know, the big bosses get paid the most. So it, you know, tips the imbalance further. But I think there's a generation in that next tier down that are ready to pop in that, you know, will change the face of the industry.
I think your experience was that there were no female leaders in the industry whom you could model yourself on. You basically had to go clawing your own way up.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, again, it's probably true of most industries. But, you know, having been in finance that was incredibly male dominated, music felt a little better. But no, I had no one that had, I couldn't imagine what my life was going to look like now when I was in my 20s, because there were no female leaders. So yeah, I think I've just grappled my way through. But I've also had amazing allies. Like, I've had brilliant bosses who have really championed me all the way through. And, you know, without them, you obviously don't surge. But I don't know, I just kept going.
How conscious are you of the need to mentor other women? I mean, I've sometimes heard the suggestion that sometimes women who get ahead, they can pull the ladder up behind them.
Oh, not me. Not me. I think it's hugely important to mentor the people coming up. And yeah, I can think of several people in my mind's eye now who, you know, I've worked with who, and, you know, I've really kind of pushed and have gone on to other businesses and really, really excelled. I'm the type of leader where my door is always open. You know, I had a funny conversation with someone last year where all of her male counterparts marched into my office demanding a pay increase, and I didn't hear a peep from her. She was actually the better of all of them. So I sat her down and said, I'm giving you a pay increase because you should be in my office asking for this. So it's just it's very important to mentor, but then also make sure that as you're leading, you're making sure that it's an equal playing field for everybody.
Yeah. And again, women tend, I've heard it suggested, that if they see a job ad, if they don't tick all the boxes, yeah, they tend not to want to, yeah, apply because of maybe an element of insecurity, whereas lads are much more likely to take the chance and try to blag their way through.
Yeah. So I think then that it's also...
Is that a fair characterization?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I particularly admire, there's the young generation coming through now as well. On the one hand, I admire it. On the other hand, it frightens me slightly. But they're not afraid of hierarchy, which is good. You know, that their voices should be as heard as much as, you know, the next person's. But I had a trail of interns coming into my office asking for, you know, X, Y and Z. And you think, oh, my goodness, this is brazen.
Coming back to the core business, promoting artists, making music. And you talked about the various waves of disruptors, be it download streaming or now AI. There's been, I think, an increasing emphasis and maybe a realization on the part of musical talent that they've got to do the live, because that's a key way to make money. And is that something that's much more in evidence now than maybe it was when you started?
Yeah, I think the tables have absolutely turned. It back in the days of CDs, as my daughter would say, in the olden days, you know, you could sell an album. And if you think of the price point of an album was, what, £15 or something, you know, you could sell millions of albums and make a fortune. And then the touring was kind of the icing on the cake. In the streaming world, because the economics are different, you can't upfront your sales like that anymore, right? You have to build audience. So if you need to build audience, you need to build a kind of a live business and a live trail. So now almost we describe it like the streaming world is kind of like the artist pension, because it just keeps coming, right? If you have a hit song, it will always monetize, whereas in a CD you got it once and then it was done, whereas now you'll always have a return on that song, but the live is where you bring the big cash in immediately.
Just looking at something in recent times, I mean, you see Harry Styles has sold out Wembley Stadium, is it for 12 nights?
12 dates, yeah.
And that's a capacity of what, 90,000?
That's right, yeah. I mean, it's incredible.
How do you explain that?
Well, you explain, he's huge. And again, it goes back to my point on audience, right? You build an audience. He's an incredible artist with a, you know, voracious fan base. You build an audience like that, they will come to see you.
And
the live show is a spectacle, right? And, you know, we did a lot of research on, you know, kind of under 25 audience, and it's all about experience. So people want to come together at those kind of things.
Fairly recently, in other words, towards the end of last year, despite having got this award as being having made an outstanding contribution at the Women in Music Awards, you've decided to step back. Now, that is as a result of some changes in the industry. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so Warner Music has changed its strategy slightly in that it's creating kind of an Anglo music centre. By that, I mean English language artists. And so as a result of that, the labels in the UK are now going to report straight into America. So that left very little of a UK business in the centre for me to look after. And so it felt like time to step away. I think the change will be good for artists, because artists are always looking to break in America, because that's where you get, back to your point, the big audience. So it will be good for artists. But for, I think it's quite, I worry that it's a moment for British culture. Until Olivia Dean more recently, there hadn't been a UK artist that had broken out globally in 7 or 8 years. Dua Lipa was the last one. Or maybe Lewis Capaldi, but Dua and Lewis. So there was a lot of navel gazing in the UK as to whether, you know, the algorithm essentially meant that, you know, small population countries were going to struggle to have, you know, big music breakouts. So by connecting the UK and US, there is some logic in then, you know, really building proper big audience and helping with the algorithm. But I think I do worry that British music and Irish music with it, because Ireland actually reports into the UK for Warner, just get diluted a little bit because America is so big.
And how do you see Irish music and Irish talent fitting into all of that? And OK, there's some people, I mean, you two obviously being the biggest example, but previously the late Sinead O'Connor, Boomtown Rats, Cars, whoever. I'm not sure if there's any kind of an emerging talent there. But, you know, how is it going? From what you're saying, it seems that they're going to have a harder time in making the breakthrough.
I think this will, if you get signed to Warner, this new structure will help. It's getting the signing in the first place. But there's an amazing executive actually at Warner in Ireland, Priscilla Cote, who does a brilliant job at representing Irish talent. And we've seen something of a signing war actually for Irish talent amongst all of the majors in the UK. We had, who have we signed? We signed Kingfisher, Amble, Florence Road, which is an all-female rock band, and, you know, then the CMAT, there's others that have been in signing wars. So I think people still look at Ireland, like it's so ingrained in our culture, and it, you know, we've a proven ability to punch so far above our weight, that it's still a hunting ground. And I think we possibly have a lot to thank Nashville for, because, you know, that kind of country music with really strong lyrics and kind of, you know, highly emotive songs is actually quite like the more traditional Irish singer-songwriter kind of bent, I guess. So that, I think that's, we've come into fashion again. So I'm hoping that we see some of these acts really break through.
Coming into studio just an hour or so ago, Isabel, we bumped into Paddy Cullivan, he of the Camembert Quartet, the 5-member Camembert Quartet, late show house band previously. I mean, a guy like that, obviously very talented and with a very talented group. I mean, how would they, starting off, okay, he's well established now, but how did they go about getting noticed, getting into the big time, as it were?
I mean, it's hard, I'm not going to lie. I think there's a couple of routes in. One goes back to your point on live. It's, you know, gigging and really building an audience. And that's definitely the artists that we've most recently signed from Ireland have been, you know, the Ambles and the Kingfishers have actually built up a big Irish following through gigging here.
Filling the Three Arena and the rest of it in some cases.
Exactly. And then, you know, one of the, there are many things I don't like about social media, but the power of social media is that you can then, you know, really grow beyond your, the city, town, country that you're sitting in. And so that done well can really help people to kind of raise above the parapet. I don't know that string quartets are quite quite going to, you know, connect on TikTok, but who knows? You know, there's plenty of room for clever marketing. But the artists, you know, there's also artists who will self-release to get noticed. So there are multiple ways in, but it is a grind and it is a tough industry to be in. But I guess the rewards are big if you can get there.
Interesting you say you're a top 40 type person, despite all the range of stuff that's available to you. I can identify with that. I mean, give me a Cars or a U2 or a Bruce Springsteen or a Dubliner CD and I'm happy in the car.
Do you know, it's funny, we did research years ago that says your musical tastes actually lock down when you're 32. So I bet all of those CDs that you're listening to bring you to a moment pre, you know, mid-30s.
Yeah, well, certainly the U2 one would anyway. And, yeah, so what other kind of things do you have you discerned from the research that you do into people's tastes and, you know, you find out where the itch is so that you can scratch, as it were, commercially?
Yeah, I mean, there's no magic solution, but you do kind of come across these gems, like, you know, you need to lock into people's musical tastes when they're young. So we get very focused on a youth audience. It's why, like, Mr. Brightside is one of the biggest streamers on Spotify, because generationally, the big cohort of subscribers kind of skew that way. But then we look kind of with our head and our hands slightly at TikTok, where, you know, a 3 second view is deemed as engagement. And so how do you actually create fandom in that world so that you kind of create crumbs so that the you know, they can go on a discovery journey to discover who the artist is and not just mindlessly scroll? So, you know, the statistics help us a bit, but you still have to kind of just be reactive to what's going on in the moment.
And what kind of overnight successes have you seen, say, on TikTok after many years of maybe obscurity, after a brief flicker of fame maybe 30 or 40 years ago?
You do see some of the one-hit wonders coming back. I'm racking my brain now. Like, before I left there before Christmas, Spandau Ballet were having a big moment with Gold because it was synced, you know, to some strange video on TikTok. So you see bizarre things pop up. But I spent a lot of time in the last couple of years at Warner, where actually you have the beauty of bringing these tracks to people for the first time. So you have really funny situations where people think they've discovered the Smiths themselves, that, you know, and then they deep dive and realize, oh, this is a band from the 80s, you know, that I didn't know existed before. You have was it Kate Bush that had that sync with Stranger Things and suddenly she was top of the charts? You know, there's really lovely moments where discovery of catalogue, what we call a catalogue, but kind of older music, feels new again. So actually the way you market that to, you know, a sub 25 audience is really engaging and really fun, as opposed to just reissuing the last album of, you know, I don't know, Fleetwood Mac.
Are there older artists, though, who may have signed away, you know, their birthright, so to speak, to music companies like Warner or whoever, and there's a whole revival of interest in them, but, you know, they're not actually gaining anything from it themselves?
Well, no, that is a myth that the artist isn't gaining. So certainly at Warner, all of our artists would gain from that, because they still have royalties on all of the music that they created. So yeah, there's absolute gain. And actually the artists who are most successful on social media like TikTok lean in themselves. You know, the Pogues, before Shane McGowan passed away, you know, we're leaning in. We have a whole department that are having conversations with, you know, all of the various artists to really reinvigorate their catalogue. Like Elton John did an excellent job. He did a duet with Dua Lipa and suddenly, you know, he was much more relevant. And, you know, it all depends on how we talk a lot about how you place yourself in culture. So the song, you know, the Smiths I mentioned earlier, is just resonating with a generation who feel very disillusioned with what's going on in the world. And so that those that's lyrically connecting to what's going on. So it's just being clever about how you place old tracks into modern culture.
Right. Your own future. What are you looking at now?
I am looking at, I'd really love to stay in the creative industries and music or beyond. I've actually really enjoyed that. We talked a lot about the clash of commercial and creativity, but it's actually what I find most exciting about the roles I've had. So I'd love to stay in that space. And I think I'm looking for a bit of balance. You know, I've been going hell for leather for the last 20 plus years. And actually, how do I, I've got a relatively young family, how do I balance family and business? And, I'd love a reason to be connected to Ireland as well. You know, it's I've always had my nose in kind of head down nose in UK businesses, but that there's a
could
moment
you see,
to look up.
Could you see yourself returning to work, to live and work in this country?
Sadly not. As my mum would say, I married an Englishman, so there's no chance of me coming back. But joking aside, I think my kids are all settled in school. I don't think it's in the near future, but who knows? You know, never say never.
Right. But it would be, if whatever you do, you know, in the future, be it in this year of 2026 or whenever, you do see it's not going to be a return to the old corporate world of high finance. It's more you've had too exciting a time to want to go back there.
No, I think I will. I'll definitely stay in the creative industries, but I don't think I want to go back to very big business. I think having been very close to, technology revolutions and small businesses that kind of, suddenly become big, I'd love to be in something that's, on the cusp of an exciting growth phase that, has it all to play for rather than just sitting in big business, I think.
Isabel Garvey, the very best of luck to you in whatever path you choose into the future. No doubt it'll be exciting. No doubt it'll be successful. Thank you indeed for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you indeed, Isabel. And you can find more insights with Sean O'Rourke on the RT Radio Player or wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you for listening.